You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. From Darwin, Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sambeek. With another episode of Talk the Walk, and I'm joined today by Pamela Trotman. Pamela's worked as a social worker for nearly 50 years, so that's pretty amazing to be sitting with her today. Much of her work has been directly or indirectly involved with working with Aboriginal people and communities. Within a year of graduating university, she was out providing social and emotional support to young people, young Aboriginal people, moving to Sydney for work opportunities under a new program funded by the federal government shortly after the 1967 referendum. Pamela's gone on to work in a variety of settings, including child protection, mental health, policy, and a lot of non-government organisations, more recently Aboriginal NGOs, across New South Wales and the Northern Territory. Pamela has written and extensively presented material nationally and internationally on both Aboriginal affairs and trauma. So welcome, Pamela. Thank you for meeting with me today.
Glad to be here.
In preparing for this interview, you sent me just a few little snippets of some of the things that you've written fairly recently. And I guess one of the things that stood out to me was your interest and the influence of reconciliation or the reconciliation movement. I guess I first came across, the reconciliation movement nearing the end of my degree as well. And I became really interested in being part of that movement. I was involved in setting up some reconciliation learning circles in the organisation that I was doing my final placement with. And I guess things rocketed from there in terms of being engaged in this space of reconciliation and working with Aboriginal people. And I'm wondering, would you say that reconciliation has been instrumental in the development of your practice framework over the years?
As you were talking, I was thinking where my reconciliation journey began. And in truth, it began on the 27th of May 1967, which is the date of the referendum, because that was, in fact, the first time I voted. The government had just, a couple of years beforehand, had just dropped the voting age from 21 to 18. And so I was, at that stage, in my, just shy of my 20th birthday.
Right.
I can remember voting in that. So it was the first time I'd ever voted, ever. Yes. And I was so overcome with and things of the power of the vote and the importance of the vote for two reasons. First of all, because I'd spent a lot of time as a child being able to be welcomed into one of the Aboriginal, what they call, we call, used to call the Blacks Camp in Gulladay, where I grew up. So that gave me a really positive view of Aboriginal people because I got to know them personally, despite the fact they were hugely marginalised and things and in all ways. And at that stage, they weren't even citizens in their own land. So there was that. And also because that referendum also removed the White Australia policy. And it just so happened that my boyfriend at the time was a Malay Muslim. Right. So I had these two exposures to different things. So that, then once the referendum happened, and Aboriginal people became Australian citizens, which meant the federal government had to take responsibility for Aboriginal affairs, it suddenly, the voices started to be heard. And I mean, it had taken all that time to get the voices, Aboriginal voices to be heard. And when I was working for those 4 years in Redfern, all day, every day, I was mixing with Aboriginal people, the activists, the people and things. And very rarely was I would go home to my white partner and my white family, and I had white friends and things. But effectively, when my bosses said to me, when they got this new program, and of course it was in linking with, it was a program in with what was then the Commonwealth Employment Service. And the Commonwealth Employment Service didn't employ social workers. They had this partnership with what was called the Child Protection, which had been the Child Protection Service.
Oh, no.
However, it became the Child Protection and Aboriginal Affairs Department.
Oh, wow.
Right. So it actually had this, and so they had a whole section in things, and so they got me to be employed and things. When that happened, my bosses literally said, Pam, there's a group of bums, go social work them. And that's how much they thought of both social workers in those and Aboriginal people. They really just weren't interested. So I did for 4 years. Every day I went out there, I had no supervision. Because I was the sole worker, I was out there all day and every day. I had to set up my own relationships.
Mm.
I got, and it was the most, you know, people talk about cultural learning and awareness. I think I soon learned when I'd overstepped the mark. Despite the fact that I was white and I worked for technically the welfare, I was very privileged within the Aboriginal community. And that's something that's been part of my life, that I've actually had the privilege of being welcomed into Aboriginal families and Aboriginal communities and things. Not so much out in remote communities, but if you can consider Jabiru, yes, when I lived in Jabiru, I was one of the few people that had close relationships with the Aboriginal people who lived in the camps out around Jabiru.
So how important was it for you to have that kind of start, do you think, being thrown in the deep end? So much change was happening within Australia politically as well. How important for you was it just to be thrown in the deep end and to learn those hard lessons straight up?
Looking back, I think they picked me because I was one of six cadets that graduated that year, because the department had put me through university. So I was one of five or six people, young social workers, who graduated and that year. So they could have chosen any one of us, but they knew, could sense that I was a bit of an adventurer, that I was actually, you know, something that could go out there and do a whole lot of things. And maybe I'd just shown some interest or something like that. In terms of shaping me, there's no doubt it shaped me. It changed, and I think what it did was actually gave me an awareness of how people of colour, and particularly people of colour, to be successful in a dominant white world, actually have to learn to walk between two worlds. So I actually had the reverse lesson of that coming from the dominant world, I was learning to walk between the two worlds. You know, and I can once, when I was in that time, the Australian Association of Social Workers Sydney branch had a meeting and we got invited, and there were a couple of really senior social workers, you know, I mean really the doyens of social work practice. One of them being Margaret Whitlam was on the panel. So I was on this panel with these other people. We were talking about, and they were asking me about, they were looking at a number of things, but they were asking me about my role in this job, because it really was a new sort of, it was groundbreaking in lots of ways. And I must have spoken with so much passion and conviction about, you know, what was going on. Another social worker, she said to me, and what's it, something like, and of course you're Aboriginal. And I said, what makes you think I'm Aboriginal? But I think that sort of notion that just because one had a sense of empathy or connection or something, that one had to be Aboriginal.
Right.
And it would, that stunned me. And so what I got was not just, I got a lot of lessons about how to learn to work cross-culturally, which are things about respecting difference, you know, and diversity, and respecting the person's right to be self-determining, that just because they're a person of colour and disadvantaged doesn't mean they can't work out what's best for themselves. And all those things which are the principles of social work practice, social work practice. But the bit that I've learnt that really has challenged me all the time is how can I convey that sense of awareness and knowledge and a sense of privilege and the sense of release that it gives, that when one starts to feel comfortable dwelling in the in-between, and not, you know, without having to negate the fact that I'm very white, I'm very middle class. In fact, I'm upper middle class in my thinking. I'm dispossessed in my social structure. I'm dispossessed as a minor English aristocracy on my mother's side.
Right.
And that's only by one generation, one, two generations. So a lot of that framework, structural framework, it's very much me. And I, if you know, if I get riled, I come out as very much the haughty, you know, English, how dare you treat me like that? You know, it just comes. It's in my genes.
Well, that's right. You bring that with you.
And so I've tried to understand how, and help other people to understand and get people to feel, find ways of recognising that where they stand and the way they view Aboriginal people, it's just, you know, that it's a no-go, it's a no-win situation. And they might be good people and they may not believe they're racist. And they're not in a sense racist, what they are is that they are so ingrained in our own culture, the whiteness, the significance, the inviolate, the unchallengeable, unquestionable whiteness of whiteness actually means that we end up behaving and thinking and behaving in ways that is tantamount to racism, because it gives it actually identifies and relates to people on the basis of their race, and it's always a negative relationship. It is never a positive one, because white, because blackness, any other colour, any other combination of colours can never be as good as white, ever, and that's the bit that I've grappled with, and it's been with my my friends and things, and I used to get really passionate about it and shriek and, you know, and all those sorts of things. But so the more I got immersed in that, the more I actually started to see my own culture from the point of view of the Aboriginal people.
Please explain.
Well, so I started to see the ugliness of whiteness. So yes. Whereas Aboriginal people, white people, all they, a lot of people can see is what they see as the ugliness or the, you know, of the Aboriginal other. People, of the other, all the negatives of the other.
But whereas you were looking at your own
I started to see the negatives. And so I have spent those decades of trying to help people to sort of recognise and own our own ugliness. Because unless we own our own ugliness, I don't think we've got a snowflake's help in hell of actually becoming effective and ethical social workers when we're working with people of colour, particularly Aboriginal people, because they are at the bottom of the heap. Even, you know, having worked with refugees, the black refugees that come to Australia actually automatically think that they've got a better blackness than the Aboriginal Australians, is my experience. They all actually, and that's because they pick up on that vibe that they've got a better blackness than the Aboriginal stuff. And, you know, that saddens me. That absolutely, it makes my heart, I cringe at it, but I also grieve. And I'm done with grieving. In the last few years, I've finally found the words to start articulating what it is. And so reconciliation in that sense it's what I would consider a product rather than an end point. That as we as non-Indigenous people start to actually engage with and actually start to see ourselves to the notions of internalised dominance, and the Aboriginal people start to see the extent of their selves and their interactions with one from the position of internalised oppression and how they relate to each other with the lateral violence and all of those sorts of things. That once, if we can start to find ways of doing that, and if we can grapple with that, and there can be healing taking place, then reconciliation is possible. But until we actually embark on that journey, forget it.
Because I'm aware that a few months ago you sent around some flyers to engage social workers in this kind of conversation, and we didn't get enough people to sign up to it. And I'm just wondering, what is it that's holding us back as a profession, as people that are working in this field, from taking that step and really looking inside ourselves and our culture and how that's impacting on the way we see the world and the way we work. Is it fear? Is it guilt? What is it that's holding us back?
I think it's any number of things, and I'm not sure that, but I think the main premise is that we are so, the cross-cultural workshops actually really do a lot of harm in this regard, is in my opinion, and a lot, this is being said a lot more openly now in what things, is that whatever we only say as white people looking at Aboriginal people and trying to work with the Aboriginals, work with the blacks, we never once look at ourselves in the mirror. We never to do that, and so we are not being taught to be reflective about how our own culture shapes who we are. Now I know how my culture shaped me because my grandmother and my mother's on my mother's side, we were a bit ostracised at school because I had things like we used the Queen's English, and so we didn't say answer. We didn't say abattoir. We didn't say, you know, we said answer, abattoirs, you know, and we would get into trouble. I would get into trouble if we used the wrong pronunciation for this language. And that actually set myself and my sisters apart. One of the teachers in high school made some comment about it. I can't remember what I said, but I know they actually picked me up on it. You know, don't be so big, you know, Pamela, you're an Australian, you're not British or something like this, you know. So,
right.
Now, we didn't speak with a plum in our mouth, but it was about, and also good grammar, good spoken grammar, you know. So I wasn't, so, you know, that's how you had to speak English, the Queen's English well, and write and understand it.
That's how you were brought up.
That's how I was brought up. But I also, as much as I was part of the white community, I was actually not part of the inner circle, both because of my association with Aboriginal people, because that kept me on the outer, but for a whole lot of other reasons, I wasn't part of the inner group. I have never been part of the inner circle anywhere, you know, and a lot of people spend their whole lives in those inner circles.
So can I take you back to those times when you were a child and you were playing with Aboriginal kids in your neighbourhood? What was it that, was there a curiosity there, or was it the way your parents instilled in you particular values around, you know, being inclusive, or what was it that helped you engage with those kids at that time?
I want to be precise here. We didn't play with our children, Aboriginal people, in our neighbourhood.
Okay, right.
Because to do so would have meant that they would have been welcome in our neighbourhood.
Right.
We were welcome in the blacks' camp, which was about a kilometre away from our home, and the Aboriginal kids were welcome in our house.
How did that arrangement come to be?
Probably because, I mean, I'm speaking about when we were between the ages of about 8 and high school, and you know, when we went into high school, where they put the blacks' camp. To get to school and to get to the swimming pool and other places, they had to walk past our house. And we were probably, a couple of things happened. Probably we would say hello, we would give the kids a drink, we would, you know, some of the kids were in our classes at school and things like that. So the normal sorts of hellos and the sense of, I mean, there is a book, Rob Garbutt, and he talks in his book about the notion of the clearing. He also cites another author who's done a lot of work on the notion of clearing, who is acceptable within that, and where the light of awareness and understanding is shown. So those people who dwell, are forced to dwell beyond the clearing, don't get a look in.
And the clearing in your community was the basically white, defined by the white
the whiteness,
neighbourhood.
The whiteness. Because no blacks lived in town, because they didn't get... Despite the fact that they were, because they were Australian citizens, I mean, we were put amongst our house, which was a war service home. We got that one, but all around our house, literally, were government housing commission houses, which had a lot of 10-pound poms, as they got called it, the immigrants, both immigrants coming to live there. So they got all the benefits of it, and within a kilometre, on the edge of town with nothing, and shanties, was this Aboriginal community.
Mm.
And so even though it was their country, they didn't belong.
Mm.
So that's the theory. And there was a there was a gully between the edge of town and where they lived, and they lived on there. And very few kids and people actually went anywhere. They weren't allowed to because it was no man's land.
Did you venture past
Yes, we were the few people that were allowed in there. So we would go, we'd ride our bikes over and we'd go in there and we'd go into the Aboriginal homes and we'd see we'd see how well they kept these humpies and things like that. We'd see all these things. And of course, they'd say, well, come and play here and things like that. And that's happened. So all along, whenever there's been an opportunity, I guess what that did is it took away any fears we had of difference with respect to Aboriginal, well, respect to coloured people.
Yeah, and I'm still not quite clear on what helped you enter that space, because there were a lot of white kids in that community that didn't go into that space.
Well, my father had grown up with, he had an Aboriginal housemate, so he was comfortable. My mother hadn't. She hadn't had any. But mother's principle is a lot about that. My mother, both of them were very strong in terms of you treat people respectfully, regardless of grace, or social standing, and that came very strongly from, particularly from my mother's side of you, is that as an upper class English person, you do respect people just because you're upper class. Doesn't mean you don't respect the people. And in fact, you've got a bigger obligation to be respectful of them because their well-being, often you're the steward of their well-being in lots of ways. That whole feudal system, you've got to really look after people because you've been invested with this power and this, privilege.
Right.
Which a lot of people exploited, but there's a whole, but that sense of stewardship, that sense of, of things, of caring for people, caring for one's community, which is probably what keeps the Queen going. That's very much embodied in that sort of notion of the landed gentry, in England.
Right, yep.
So this notion of that, that we were privileged in so many ways, but that doesn't mean that we, and that actually put an extra responsibility on us to make sure we behaved well towards the less privileged.
So has that understanding or notion that you've carried about status and privilege from England, has that helped you move into the space of thinking about culture and white privilege?
No, I don't think it has, not directly anyway.
Yeah.
I think what really started me to think about it when I started grappling with the whole notion of, if I was making these connections and working well with Aboriginal people and I was seeming to do all this, what's the difference between what I'm doing? What's different? And why aren't other white people doing the same? Particularly, when I was working in agencies, and I won't name the agency, but I was working in an agency where we were working, it was an Aboriginal agency. I mean, since the referendum, they aboriginalised a lot of the... So the Aboriginal people got brought into jobs, and so we had them in the workforce and things like that. And one of the things that I've grappled with all along is, why were Aboriginal people, from my perspective, and if one listens to Aboriginal people, their perspective, why are Aboriginal people always treated as second-class workers in some ways, like not being given the authority, to speak, their voices are not listened to, or all of those sorts of things. In one organisation I worked for, we had a combination of white professionals, social workers and psychologists, and we had Aboriginal people who had come out of their really difficult situations and done a series of courses and ended up actually having got a university degree.
Mm.
And I can remember one day in a staff meeting, one of the persons who was not a social worker but a psychologist actually turned to the Aboriginal workers. They were all counsellors and we all got paid the same amount, and said, well, I'll do the therapeutic bit, you can do the welfare stuff. because you're not equipped to do, you're not skilled to do that. You know? I mean, that's the bit that used to make me cringe. I used to think, if you could only hear yourself,
yes,
if you could just hear yourself, what you sound like, it is so ugly, it's not funny.
Yes. So how do you shine the light on that?
In those days, I used to get really agitated and I'd lose my cool and everything like that. And of course, the more I tried to articulate it and the more they chose, because I believe it was a choice, to ignore what I was saying, because to listen to it and really give any credence to what I was saying would mean they might have to consider changing. The more I thought that was, the more they, it sort of put the onus on me, oh, you're not explaining it properly, so you can, so I would try and repeat it. Say it differently. You're just repeating yourself, Pam. So they not just negated me, but they negated the voice and things. So it's only in the last 2 to 3 years that I've actually found that voice.
And been able to articulate it and to being a people able to in articulate a way that it. Brings yeah. them into the conversation.
And the first thing that when I first got an understanding of it, which was back in about 2004 or 5, and I was working for this Aboriginal organisation, and I got invited by the editor of the NT Association of Social Workers newsletter for me to do a little article on my work with Aboriginal people. And by some sort of strange coincidence, I'd read an article not long beforehand by a guy called D'Angelo, who, and I can give you all the details of that later.
Great.
But he was essentially talking about the internalised dominance, and that was the first time I'd heard that expression, yes. internalised dominance of heterosexuality.
Okay.
The assumptions around what the people make based on the sense of dominance. So that gave me a conceptual framework of understanding things. Mm-hmm. Then he also talked about, and then there's also the notion of internalised depression, how people operate. And Paulo Freire talked about it, and I'd read about that. Things, but there are other articles where I'd actually, more recent ones, of actually understanding what is internalised oppression. Because both of them become normalised.
Yes.
And because they're normalised, they're legitimised. So, you know, that, and they're legitimised, and ourselves, you know, it may not be without people, they're legitimised and things. So it's a case of how does one confront, you know, confront them, which is what, why, where I'm at to now in trying to, with reconciliation. I mean, my voice, I've had a loud enough voice because when I was in 2006, I was on the national board of the Australian Association of Social Workers, and I'd only just gotten on, and things, and at the meeting, there'd been a sort of an item of all the different portfolios of Indigenous, but it had never been activated, despite the fact that there had been an Indigenous social worker on the board for several years, but then nothing. So I came in from afternoon break or some break, and I got told that I was being given the Aboriginal portfolio, because this woman, the Aboriginal woman, was her term was up and she wasn't renewing.
Right.
So I got given that portfolio.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, holy dooly, you know, I mean, it's both, I mean, I cried because I thought it was both an honour and a huge, you know, huge responsibility. When they said do this, I took them at their word and I went out. So I set up what was to become the Indigenous Committee. Started off as a working party.
Right.
And I recruited 6 people, Indigenous people, to be on that working party, which guided the ASW and things until the president, towards 2008, the president became more proactive and things, and then I wasn't on the board any longer and things, but then I got recruited people from across Australia.
So what was the role of that group? Was it to feed into the ASW on ways that they could really look at themselves?
The terms of reference, I can't remember the details of the terms of reference, but essentially, the idea of looking at ourselves, no, it was about how to inform social policy.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues of working in this context is it's very politically fraught, and So I set up that committee, and then I wasn't on the board any longer. And then the president, he took over, he's been the convener of that committee. And then in 2012, when they had a whole new president and a whole new board and things, several board members resigned virtually within months, 6 months of the election. I put my hand up to be on the board, back on the board. Mm. So what was one of the first things that happened? Reactivate the committee.
Interesting.
And things, anyway, I wasn't able to because the committee, by that stage, the water had changed, moved on and things like that. But it's, I mean, I think we've still got a long, long way to go. I've had to recognise that what I think is as plain as the nose on your face is actually, most people don't even see that they've got a nose. They look straight beyond it. And it's not just Australian social work. I think Australian social work is reflective of the wider Australian society.
Yes.
I think if we had the same referendum now, it wouldn't get up.
Right.
I really believe that it wouldn't get up.
Mm.
And I think the people's hearts have hardened the notion of emergency, the NT emergency intervention. I mean, that is the biggest obscenity out.
Mm.
Biggest obscenity out.
Mm.
And and we didn't, as an association, we didn't fight. We didn't fight to struggle with it, to say, look, hang on, this is not right.
Yes.
You know, we recognise this huge number of issues. We can't, because we're not going to pretend otherwise. But we're not going to, this way of doing it is wrong in so many ways. You know.
So what was it that held the ASW back from really speaking out against that? Do you think?
I think they were so caught up in being, I think they were too much part of the system. You know, and because there was a whole lot of social workers. Yes. Who were in working in the place, people like Centrelink and things, you know, they wanted to respect. I think they wanted to respect that these social workers are trying to do a good position.
Yeah, and they had to work within that new policy.
They
framework.
Had to work within it, but that didn't mean that I don't believe that would have necessarily stopped the Australian Association from saying, we don't believe this is the right way to go. We will support the social workers who are working in the system or choose to work in the system, but that we actually do not believe this is the way to go. I don't think they got that far.
Mm. So going back to the example you gave before of the psychologist who made that really awkward comment for you that was reflective of his internal dominance.
Oh, it was a her.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I made that assumption.
Yeah,
what I'm thinking about is social workers that might be listening to this conversation and they want to actually take themselves on this journey to really look inside at their own internal dominance. What would you suggest would be a way forward for them to start doing that?
I can only say what worked for me. So, for example, I think recognising and being able to even draw a picture of who one is and where one fits within the world and actually attach to that all the privileges that happen, you know, what, you know, things. And so what is it that, how we might be privileged, where we fit inside that clearing, you know, using that language and things, but just how much, what sort of connections we have, what sort of voice we have or don't have.
Mm-hmm.
It's a journey, and I'm taking a few of my supervisees on this journey to looking at it. And of course the biggest one, as you mentioned, I think when we were first talking, is the fear of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I mean, we are secure in ourselves and who we are if by believing that our way of being, doing and knowing is actually a good way. But if we start to create doubts about that's the things, then that can be hugely challenging. It does take a kind of emotional and spiritual maturity and maybe courage.
Yes.
And I think that maturity is, I mean, if you're listening to the politicians, I actually wonder whether, you know, that I don't think Australia as a nation has got that level of maturity.
Yes.
That level of awareness and but also believing sense of confident of this is who I am. It doesn't mean it's a good or bad, but this is how it is. And then once I can say, well, this is how things, I can be more, I can step back and say, well, look, this might be the dominant thinking, but do I have to go along with it? Is it something that I think is it? And I think when I listen to a lot of politicians, and you listen to them, particularly people like Peter Dutton and our Treasurer, John Howard and Tony Abbott, if one listens to the voice inside of what they're saying, what they're really saying is that they are so busy trying to defend their position. They say they're trying to argue about why it's the best way, but really it's a defence, because it's a defence of their position, their mindset, their worldview. And they do it so stridently.
So is part of the journey having to look at the mind view of the others that you're talking about, being able to put yourself in their shoes and look at their worldview? If you think about Aboriginal people and their worldview being so different to ours, to have the ability to look inside at your own worldview and how that impacts on them, do you have to have an understanding of their worldview?
I actually think it's not just about Aboriginal things. I mean, it's about recognising that of difference, because not all Aboriginal people have the same worldview, not all white people have the same worldview. Mm. We all have different worldviews for different reasons.
Mm.
And that's why, you know, that's what creates the diversity of the society and the thinking and all those sorts of things. But unless we recognise that our view, even within, forget about another country, but even if we get to the point of recognising that our view, even in within our own society, is actually not the only voice, not the only view, then but politically that's a bit hard to do, because then they might have to give some credit to the opposition's voice and things like that. So that's why I say there's a vested interest in maintaining this blindness, this blinkered approach. And it is about power, but it's not as such, but it's about, but I think there is a real apprehension. If I'm not right, where am I then? And that's what I mean, that sense of maturity, of not knowing who one is and where one fits and things. And so that's why I think the country heaved a sigh of relief when Malcolm Turnbull got to be Prime Minister, because his use of language and his approach to things is far less dogmatic, and which is probably why he's having issues with all these other people and things. But there has to be room in one's thinking and in one's heart for another. For another concept, another idea, that there may be a different way of doing it. Now, that's the case in relationships. How many times in sitting as a counsellor, couple counsellor, the issues are about one person is really pissed off because the other one won't go along with their dominant view. So it's that same sort of thing, is that there's no room for the other, for other thinking. Then we've got real issues as a society.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the article that you wrote for the book Reconciliation and Social Work, which was edited by Christine Fijo King and Jan Puna, which came out in 2014. You've talked a lot about internalised dominance today. I'm wondering, is there other themes or things that you've written in that chapter that social workers should be aware of, or we can bring to their attention?
I used in the latter part of that chapter, in terms of understanding internalised dominance, I actually used the notion of the fairy tale, Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, Who's the Fairest of Them All? And how that we actually need to, well, what happens if we don't look in the mirror, and if we just always want the mirror to tell us that we're the fairest, which is what happened to the stepmother, you know, that she couldn't countenance, the stepmother couldn't countenance the notion that there were two beautiful women in this world who were close to the king. So what did she have to do? She had to get rid of one. And so, but the mirror kept telling her otherwise. So when she looked into it and said, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all, the mirror would have the gall to say, sorry, Snow White.
Yes.
And so what did she do? She plotted to get rid of. And that's that sense of alienation, rejection, you know, those things of actually pushing aside and denying the place of somebody. You know, so that's what she effectively did. Except, as often happens, there's some intervention that happens and things. And so I've written in that story and used that we actually need to start if we really are going to grapple with our sense of internalised dominance, and in some issues we have internalised oppression too, because as women, you know, or as gay people, or as whatever, we may actually have some elements of internalised oppression, which causes us to not be, you know, to behave in different ways that, you know, things. And so we're not just, it's not just all one or one or the other. It's not a binary as someone recently sort of talked about.
So having looked at this really in your own life and the impact of internalised dominance and perhaps internalised oppression for yourself, how has that played out in your work? What has changed because of your understanding of that?
I can't give any precise examples to it, but one of the things that really makes me believe that somewhere along the line, you know, that so in that my, the Sound of Music, somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good. That it's now a decade, over a decade, since I worked specifically with Aboriginal people, or closely with Aboriginal people, except for a very short stint. And even then, that was nearly 8 years ago. When I go to things like the NAIDOC Day rally or march, I'm welcomed in to walk behind the banner of the Larrakia people. And when I'm invited to sit in the front row with the other elders, and I'm encouraged, and people greet me and acknowledge me. And these are people who are tough cookies. They're not, you know, they are people that will stand up there and they'll be making, they'll be telling everybody exactly what they think of the world. But when they see me, they literally, in many cases, embrace me. And I think that to me is the indication, not that I've made it, but that I've actually been able to establish and sustain relationships with people. And they're relationships of respect and trust. But out of that has come that sense that we have, that has come, and it's mutual respect and mutual trust. Because there's times when I said to them, hang on, that's not the right way to treat me. I'm going to concentrate on learning how not, you know, to treat you the right way, but please don't treat me that way, because that's not good for you or for me if you treat me that way.
It just got me thinking about recently, one of the challenges I have had is sometimes in my conversations with Aboriginal people, they use language like half caste and quarter caste and things like that, and that makes me cringe.
Yeah.
So is that, would that be an example of a time when you say, actually, don't do that?
No, never. Never, because what it is that to me is an indication of their internalised oppression. When I was working with another Aboriginal agency where they had people from town Aboriginal people and from community Aboriginal people who were traditional full-blood people, mixed with the town people were mixed race. The town people considered the community people as miles. They put them down. Absolutely, and I mean the term mile in Aboriginal language is a real put down. It means you're a total ignoramus and you really have no value.
Right.
So you're a mile. I mean, this was in a small, supposedly therapeutic and bloody environment.
Yes.
You know, so this is how they were treating each other.
Yes.
And the traditional people were treating the other people as yellow fellas.
Yellow fellas. How do you challenge that internalised oppression in the way they talk to each other?
I don't think you can challenge it. I think this is okay. One of the things that's probably influenced me. There's two people, as much as he was dead just within a year of me having coming into life here. But there's two principles that I've tried to follow. And the other one, of course, was the decades, centuries, millennia beforehand. The principles, the Mahatma Gandhi's principles of peace and those sorts of things. I mean, I don't know how I got those, but I grew up, they were very powerful. And the other one is the life of Christ, that acceptance and the treatment of people and things like that. So for me, being a good Christian, the challenge was, forget it about with it, was that I had, how did I find that way? You know, how did I find that? And that for that's another story. And that came out about because I was dealing with violence in my own family. And I can remember as a teenager and thinking, oh, God, we'd just been to church and everything was just going, And I can remember standing in the rubble of this total outburst from my mother and sweeping up literally the rubble of everything she'd thrown. And I'm thinking, God, there's got to be another way. Help me find another way. And so that's been what I've been out to do all my life. That's been the prevailing thing. Forget about Aboriginal, forget about whatever.
Mm.
It's that, how do I find that path of peace?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, peace for self and non-violence. How do I do all of that? Which is a huge challenge.
Mm.
A huge challenge.
Mm.
And I've only, probably, I was in my 60th year before I discovered and realised that I'd actually had managed to achieve most of it, because I had a very challenging, powerful, challenging situation where if I hadn't have said decades practising, I would have ended up being very violent myself, because I was in the most awful of situations. So it's been and it's been more religious rather than anything, because I don't believe that Christ. I mean, I follow in Christ's footsteps. I try to follow in Christ's footsteps. However, I don't believe that Christ is the only way, because I don't think God is so geographical. It's just a sense about my own journey in learning how to be as a human. And what it means to be a human.
Yes.
That's the bit, to me, that's the big challenge. And because there's one inalienable aspect that I think we forget, is that we are all humans. And the more we can learn to embrace our own humanity, means we can embrace and dance with other people in their humanity. And that's the bit that I've, you know, that's what I see as being the important thing to do, and that we can rejoice in our differences, and we'll have we're not going to agree with each other, but that's okay.
Mm. Mm.
I love living in Darwin because two reasons, because it's multicultural, but it's also got very strong evidence of the disadvantage of Aboriginal people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in your face, but you've got all those other those things.
Mm.
And so it reminds us constantly we need to grapple with this. This is something we need to grapple with. The other thing I like is it's actually so close to the rest of the world. It's as close to the rest of the world, if not closer, than other parts of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed my worldview, when that sort of sense of how I relate to the world.
Mm.
So, for example, I don't think anything of, jumping on a plane and going to India for 3 or 4 days, if I could invite it for a conference.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
You know, it's there. Just get all the paperwork right. And, you know, I think, and recently I just got an airfare, which is about the same price as a return airfare Darwin-Sydney or Darwin-Melbourne,
wow,
all the way to India and back.
So that opens you up to a lot more opportunities.
You know, it just opens the whole world up. And instead of it just being, it makes one a citizen of the world.
Mm. So before we finish up today, I'd like to ask you about, because you sent me a small snippet from your article on the healing powers of the reconciliation dances, which is a fascinating metaphor that you've developed. I'm wondering if you could explain that to our listeners.
Well, there's a couple of things that happened in my life. When I was a small child, I've been this height since I and I was a big kid by the time I was 12. I've not only grown a little bit, probably just a centimetre since I was 12. And I used to want to be, I loved to try and do ballet. Well, you can imagine, I just wasn't going to do it because I was 9.5 stone, which in those days is something like 60 kilograms or something like that. Mm. So I was this big lump of a kid, you know, at 12, 11, you know, anything. But I loved music.
Right.
Anyway, I use this metaphor and I talk about it, actually describe in the chapter about why I used it, and it was a little vignette I had where I was with a group at a workshop, and it was a weekend retreat type workshop, and this was way back in the 70s and things, and there was this spunky guy who was, you know, amongst a whole group of women and a couple of other not so spunky men. Anyway, he had all the, some of the women was vying with, you know, each other to get his attention and things. But I actually didn't have any confidence whatsoever that I could get his attention because I didn't have enough faith in my physical attractiveness. In fact, I had no faith in my physical attractiveness. Anyway, so we were dancing, and so I just danced. I danced and I danced and I danced, and I didn't care what happened, and I wasn't doing. And he ended up joining me and dancing with me. And that's the metaphor that so one of the things that is about learning to dance, learning to dance one's own tune, you know, to find the music of one's life and to dance and to celebrate that. And the more we can learn to do that in ourselves, I think the more we can start to dance different dances with different people.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it the reconciliation dances because I've talked about, in the chapter, I talk about the dances of reconnection, you know. So, mm-hmm. so they're healing dances, you know, that you, and people don't have to join in. They can sit there, but they can still be part of it and things. But it's this whole notion of movement. It's not just brain stuff. It's the whole body embracing this notion of together, that mm-hmm. we're moving together. We're moving, in a sense, to the same music. Mm-hmm. But we're responding differently to it, but we're still doing it in a sense, you know.
So is this useful in terms of micro work that you might be doing with a client one-on-one, and also community work where you might be working in communities? Is this metaphor?
I think it is. I have used it individually with clients, but I haven't. I've only articulated it since I've moved away from being actively involved in work, agency work. And being more in the private practice. And now I don't even have any clients because I'm so busy trying to focus on my writing that I found I couldn't, my head required a different, the headspace required and the mindset required to write was completely different to one that talking about therapeutic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't do it two or three days a week, but I didn't. And of course the writing always took precedence.
Right. And the section that you sent me was called the Dance Creation Story, which really sets out the early days of, you know, how you came to be working with Aboriginal people and I guess the influences, the people that you came across at that time. So couldn't you explain a little bit about, yeah, the Dance Creation Story and I guess the impact that that's had on your developing practice over the years?
Well, I've been very privileged in the sense that as much as I was this raw, eager, ignorant, somewhat brash probably, young social worker who was trying to do a good thing, that a number of particularly Aboriginal women were in the early stages. I'm talking about in the set when I was 23 and they said, go out there. And, you know, and I did it. I was out there. And I got to know these women in the course of my work. We built up really strong relationships and things. And they were my guides and my mentors. And they were, one of them was called Muriel. She would just look at me and say, Pam, that's not a good way, you know. And she wasn't condemning or anything like that. It was just beautiful. These two women, and what was really important, because I cite her and tell the story of Muriel, I actually made contact with Muriel's daughter, whom I knew because, you know, when I was working with Muriel, and I got to know the daughter. And I rang and I said, oh, contacted her, and I wanted her to let her know what I'd written about her mum to make sure she was comfortable about that going public. And it was interesting because when I contacted her, she'd read it, she said, oh, that's mummy. Because mummies have long since dead.
Yes.
She said, oh, that's mummy all over, you know. Yeah. So, and it is about, I think, learning to walk a little way. And if we can't actually dance, we can at least walk a little way with each other in harmony. And I had that brought home to me last August when I went to a one-day conference in Newcastle with Chris Stan. And it was all about the concerns and in New South Wales of the new stolen generations and the Aboriginal people and things.
Mm.
And at lunchtime, they had a nice buffet lunch. However, there were no tables to sit at, and I wanted to get out of things. And so anyway, there was only a very few tables to sit at and things. And I thought, well, I don't have to spend time with Christine. I'll go and chat up. And there were two middle-aged Aboriginal women sitting at a table. And I asked them if I could join them. things, and they must have felt, one of them must have felt comfortable with me, because when she sat down, she saw that I had something on my plate that she didn't get, and she liked it. So she said, "Can I have that?" And of course, so there was something about just my demeanour that made her feel comfortable about asking it. And then the other one kept looking at me and kept looking at me, and she said, "I know you." And when we worked it out, she had come to, I set up in the early 70s, I set up hostels for Aboriginal, for these young girls, for these young women to live in Sydney.
Yes.
So that somewhere nice where they could live and safe where they could live. And these two mentors were the house mothers that I'd recruited. This woman in her 50s, she said, "I came to visit my, must have been a cousin or a sister, but who was one of the residents in this hostel." And she said, "I remember you." 45 years later. And I thought, you know, she was only there for a short while. I think I must have got permission for her to stay there so she could come and, you know, get a sense of, because these kids were country bush, you know, never. And she said, "I remember you." So she could then give me the stories of how all these women from that part area, they've all made successes of their lives and everything like that. But I was blown away.
Yes.
45 years later,
yes,
she remembered me.
Mm.
So, and I remembered her. So we remembered the essence of each other. One of the other things that really shaped my practice, whether regardless of with my practice as a therapist or working people, is a very brief and not a huge academic article by a woman called Babette Rothschild.
Ah, yes.
And she's written a lot on trauma, huge amount on trauma.
Mm.
But the article that I read back in 2004 or 5 or something like that, is an article called, and she calls it Mirror Mirror, Our Brains Are Hardwired for Empathy. And she talks about the importance of the empathic connection.
Mm.
And I up until that point, I saw empathy as being like I would have some understanding of my client and what was going through. But when I'm reading that article, I realised that the empathic connection is a very dynamic thing. What's happening with people in the here and now, and that because of mirror neurons, we actually are constantly sussing out what the other person is meaning. And it's beyond words. It's all, you know, that's why, you know, it's beyond what, it's beyond language, it's beyond words. It's about things. And I think
the unspoken.
In fact, it's the unspoken. The more I started to listen and listen to the unspoken, the more it actually helped me to understand the pain of the person, which is what I talk about in the woundedness. But one of the things I think what they remembered, that we each left a bit of an imprint on each other, that our brains remembered, can't remember this, but remembered that wasn't a bad interaction.
Yes.
You know, it's a bit like if we have a good meal, we might remember the details of meal or something, or we hear a beautiful piece of music.
Mm. There's some fondness in that.
But there's something there that when it comes again, the brain will automatically respond to it in the positive.
Mm.
Automatically respond to it in the positive.
Mm.
And I think that's for me, that confirms the notion of that whole notion of that, what it does is right, of going gently through the world. And, but you know, all those things that we do need to tread carefully and gently through the world. And the reason I've said, you know, said to a lot of Aboriginal people, look, I'm only going to try and do what I can do and do it the best I can, because I may not be able to do any good, but I want to try and make sure I do damn well don't do too much harm. That's how people remember you. Whether you know, they may not remember any good you've done, but they do remember if you've done any harm. And, you know, and because our lives are so intertwined, I mean, who would think that I rock up to a thing and 45 years later, people, our lives, we do meet each other, we do encounter each other. Mm. And if we want to build that sense of energy, life's energy from our encounters, we actually do need to treat each other well.
I really love that idea of treading gently in the world and with people. So I'd like to finish on that note, because I'm aware that we've run over the hour. And I know that we haven't even touched on any of the work that you've been doing and writing about in terms of trauma. So I think that might be one we have to come back to at another time, if you're willing.
Yes, I'll be. Yeah.
So do you have any final words you'd like to say? I guess, to the people listening?
I guess I'd like to say to anybody working in any cross-cultural context is a couple of things. Be aware of your own culture and how it shapes your thinking and your demeanour. The whole way you think about and feel about the other. Because if we've got any apprehensions, then the other will pick that up. No matter how much we disguise or try, we think we can disguise it. It comes through loud and clear. And it's also about being accepting, recognising. I mean, we have to accept ourselves. And there's a quote from Judith Herman that in her book on trauma and trauma recovery, which is just brilliant. But she talked about integrity, Maya, and I think there's a bit of it written in there, if I may. Integrity is the capacity to create and maintain synergy between the emotional, intellectual, and spiritual self. When we act in oppressive or discriminating ways, we risk disrupting the delicate balance of the inner self, which in turn can cause us to disconnect with one or more parts of our essential self. That disconnection has the potential to be as equally destructive as if we were ourselves the victims of oppression or discrimination. Now, I wrote that in 2001 after I had read the Judith Herman's definition of integrity.
Right.
Which is about, you know, to actually face the realities of this and the dreadfulnesses of this world, and to do so without despair. And that the more we can make connections with these, that builds and reconnects and things. So I'd encourage people to look up the last paragraph of the chapter of Judith Herman's book. It's called The Healing Relationship.
Great. So we'll list Judith Herman's book along with some of the others that you've mentioned today in the show notes for people to follow up after they've listened to this conversation. Pamela, I'd just like to thank you for nearly 50 years of wisdom and knowledge you've shared with us this morning, and you've only just touched on it very briefly, I'm sure. And we'll definitely follow up with another conversation around trauma. That would be really fascinating. I don't know if you wanted to give a plug for your book. It's probably a bit early at this stage, is it?
I'll give you the working title so people could keep an eye out for it when it comes. The working title is Journeys Beyond Woundedness Triumphing Over Trauma.
Sounds great. I look forward to reading that one.
Okay.
So thanks again for your time.
Thank you. That's what I enjoyed doing it.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.